from KQED.
Support for the California Report comes from Stanford Children's Health, the Bay Area's dedicated physicians network exclusively offering pediatric and obstetric care. More at stanfordchildrens.com. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. And Digital Foundry, working with leading organizations to jumpstart digital innovation. More online at digitalfoundry.com.
Homelessness is a growing problem across the state. Coming up on the California Report, how some cities are trying to move beyond shelters and provide permanent housing. Advocates say it could save us money.
For that population, it costs $60,000 or $70,000 a person to not be housed. They go to the emergency room sometimes 80 or more times in a year.
And here's an issue that's been bothering many of us who are children of immigrants and grew up in California. How do we pass on our mother tongue?
Aide is my mom. She's a first-generation Cuban immigrant. I'm the generation in between, and I'm bilingual. So now the onus is on me to pass Spanish along to Lucia.
I maybe understand about 40 to 50 words.
We also dig into a new book about the history of American comedy by Cliff Nesteroff.
He just has this amazing eye for lurid but compelling tales.
And with Thanksgiving coming up, how you can avoid wasting food. I'm Queena Kim. All that is coming up on the California Report. As the weather turns cold and wet, people living on the streets are scrambling to find shelter. And like a lot of cities around the state, San Jose has been grappling with homelessness, especially since it shut down the Jungle last year. That was one of the nation's largest homeless encampments. The city forced out about 300 people, but that's just a fraction of the homeless population in San Jose. A year later, the Jungle is fenced off. But thousands of people are still camping out in creek beds and freeway underpasses all over the city. KQED's Rachel Miro tells us San Jose is starting to move beyond shelters to give the homeless a permanent place to live.
On a busy street corner in downtown San Jose, Brian Rodriguez and his wife, Andrea, live on the grounds around Grace Baptist Church, two of about 20 people who do so on any given night. This couple has been together
32 years.
32 years, yeah. We're high school sweethearts.
He's 50, she's 49, and they've been homeless for the better part of 2 years now. They used to own a five-bedroom house in San Jose, but a complicated series of job and health setbacks led them from that home to motel rooms, to a car, and then to the creek beds of San Jose, including the Jungle, which used to stretch along a waterway called Coyote Creek.
My wife was, like, clinging to me, but we had nowhere to go. We had nowhere to go.
The two of them help each other maintain a positive attitude in circumstances that would lay most people low. They lost most of their stuff in police sweeps. And then there are the health issues. Andrea has advanced arthritis. She suspects the damage was done in her teens and 20s when she played softball as a catcher.
They did my MRIs and stuff, and my knees are bone to bone.
Andrea needs to replace her knees. She has Medi-Cal, but she has no place to recuperate from the operations. Brian has Medi-Cal too, but he can't refrigerate the insulin he takes for diabetes. And he's learned the hard way, if insulin cooks in the South Bay heat, it's no good. Being homeless creates problems that make it hard to get off the streets. This is why many cities with large homeless populations like L.A., San Francisco, and San Diego have committed to a concept called housing first.
They need a lot of help, and it's actually less expensive to help them, much less expensive.
Jeff Morgan is president of First Community Housing. The San Jose nonprofit is one of several in California that builds and manages housing developments specifically for people who would otherwise be chronically homeless.
For that population, it costs $60,000 or $70,000 a person to not be housed. They go to the emergency room sometimes 80 or more times in a year, or there are police calls. So there's a lot of criminalization of the homeless. People are out on a park bench and they They're cited for being on a park bench. Well, where else are they supposed to go?
We're standing on another busy street corner, less than 2 miles from where Brian and Andrea Rodriguez live. Tucked behind a Pizza Hut, there's a large pit covered with vegetation. This is where First Community plans to build more than 100 apartments.
Dedicated to permanently supportive housing for the chronically homeless here in Santa Clara County.
The permanently marks a key strategy shift away from emergency shelter beds and transitional housing. Supportive also marks a shift. Second Street Studios will have almost 9,000 square feet of ground floor space for a health clinic, an office space for case managers, one for every 20 residents.
It's more efficient, frankly, for service providers to come in and do what they do. They don't have to travel to individual homes or to people out on the street.
But it isn't cheap. A complex blend of local, state, and federal pots of money finance these units. Each costs $350,000 to $400,000 to develop, not including the supportive services. With 1,400 chronically homeless people, San Jose would need 10 Second Street studios. That takes money, land, and willing neighbors.
This is a neighborhood, and I sometimes think that the city forgets that.
Homeowner Aurelia Sanchez hated having the jungle a few blocks from her doorstep. The city, she says, did a lousy job controlling the garbage and crime.
It was hell.
This 63-year-old grandmother wants the homeless housed.
Get no argument from me there.
But she suspects many of the people camping out here come from someplace else.
Maybe if people had them at their creek in their neighborhood, they would be telling their cities, you know what? Let's do something about this.
Other cities in the region, like Sunnyvale and Gilroy, have a small stock of permanent supportive housing units. Advocates say it's a promising start. Construction on Second Street Studios breaks ground next fall. They'll open their doors to the homeless in 2018. For the California Report, I'm Rachel Miro in San Jose.
Water, Mr. Rango. Water.
As Californians, we have to pull together and save water in every way we can.
We've been getting some rain and even some early snow in the Sierra. Enough snow that some ski resorts are actually opening early this year. But do not stop conserving water, because the drought isn't going anywhere. Here to give us an update on all things drought is KQED science editor Craig Miller.
Some things drought, anyway. Hey, Quina.
Hey, so as I just said, we've been getting rain all over the state.
Pretty much.
But it seems like the solution to this drought is going to be way bigger than just getting rain.
True.
In fact, there's a new report out saying that we've got to start rethinking water rights.
Yeah, and I think it's significant for a couple of reasons. One is the source. It's the Public Policy Institute of California, which these are not folks who are grinding an axe on one side of the debate or the other. They're playing it down the middle. Their research is pretty much beyond reproach. And so they are now attacking the sacred cow. They're saying it's time to make some changes in the water rights system in California. Water rights in this state are sacrosanct. They're like property rights. They are property rights. They determine the pecking order when water is short, who gets what and when. And the PPIC is saying, it's time to attack that. Not throw out the whole system, because they know that's probably not realistic, but to make it more even-handed, like Australia, where what they've done is they put a system in place where when water is short, everybody, as they say, takes a haircut. And also, the way it stands now, certain property rights owners in California can kind of game the system a little bit. And the PPIC says it's also time to change, tinker with things so that that can't happen.
And by gaming the system, do you mean that they're like running the wells dry, taking water from the Delta, or what does that
mean? It's a special case. It gets a little complicated, mm-hmm. but people that have actually two different types of water rights can kind of toggle back and forth, hop back and forth from one to the other, whichever one is most advantageous to them at the time.
And just sort of take unlimited water, more or less.
Exactly.
Yeah. So tinkering with those rights is going to be a big thorny process, and we're not even sure if it's going to happen at all. So in the meantime, the governor says that we need to extend these water restrictions that he put in place in April.
Yeah, well, he certainly wants to keep the option open. And so the executive order he put out last week says if by the end of January, here's the wording, quote, drought conditions persist, then the range of watering and other restrictions that have already been in place would run through October of next year. Now, I got curious about that. It's like, how do we know if drought conditions persist? So I asked the State Water Board how we'll know, and the answer I got back was, they will. Okay? They will persist regardless of how much rain we get.
So how does that work?
And I should say, by the way, that we're off to a pretty good start. You know, a lot of places around the state are over 100% of normal already, although it's really early in the game. And don't be surprised if December disappoints a little bit, because the latest forecasts out of NOAA are that the big stuff may not hit until January, February. But I have heard scientists say that it would take double the statewide average of precipitation to make up the cumulative rain and snow deficit from this four-year drought. Now, if that actually happens, I have to say the impacts from that would be biblical. And we would all be looking to build an ark at that point.
You want to give us a little update on Folsom Lake? It looks like the reservoir, which is east of Sacramento, is at an all-time low.
Yeah. Well, that's an illustration of this water deficit that we've been talking about. And so it's gotten a lot of attention. But Folsom Lake happens to be, although it's a big reservoir, it's fairly shallow. And so it can fill up pretty quickly. And I wouldn't be surprised if the kind of winter they're predicting, we get topped up in some of the reservoirs like that.
Well, thanks for the update, Craig.
You bet.
KQED science editor Craig Miller. Our next story speaks to a dilemma many of us children of immigrants are facing. How do we teach our kids the language we grew up with? Here in California, fewer Latinos are speaking Spanish at home. KPCC's Leslie Beristain-Rojas knows the issue all too well, and she tells us how some second-generation parents in Los Angeles are trying to change that.
It's Saturday morning in a small storefront classroom in Long Beach. Preschoolers and their parents bounce along to a song. Afterward, they talk amongst themselves in Spanish, some with more difficulty than others.
It is challenging because I've spoken English for 30 years of my life.
That's Mariela Salgado. She and her two young daughters are here at the Family Nest, a part-time Spanish immersion school. The parents that come here are mostly Latino. Many of them grew up in the U.S. Like Salgado, who was three when her family came from Mexico. She grew up in Culver City, went to Pepperdine, got an MBA, and assimilated.
When I was by myself, you know, I went about my own usual normal life, which involved English speakers. But now that I have children, I realize the importance of those traditions.
But here's where it gets complicated.
Because I speak English so much better at this point, I don't speak enough Spanish to them.
Welcome to the future of Spanish in America. By now, more than half the nation's adult Latino population is U.S.-born. And studies show each year, fewer Latino households speak Spanish. Mark Hugo Lopez is with the Pew Research Center.
The Census Bureau projects that within just a few years, we're going to reach about one-third of Hispanic young people living in a household where only English is spoken.
A growing number of these young people have non-Latino partners. Throw in busy lives with work, school, and teaching Spanish to the kids isn't easy. Which brings me to someone I'd like you to meet.
Hola.
This is Lucia, my 9-year-old daughter. She's a third-generation Cuban-American. And one other person.
Hola, yo soy Aide.
Aide is my mom. She's a first-generation Cuban immigrant. I'm the generation in between, and I'm bilingual. So now the onus is on me to pass Spanish along to Lucia. I'm not doing a stellar job.
I maybe understand about 40 to 50 words. Not that much.
What does my mom think of this?
Es una lástima, un poquito de lástima.
Oh, you hear that? Es una lástima. That means it's a shame. She thinks Lucia should be fluent by now. On weekends, my mom tries to expand Lucia's vocabulary.
Mantequilla.
Mantequilla.
Bueno.
Truth is, I've tried. I took Lucia to weekend immersion school when she was younger. Let's just say she resisted.
I hated it. In my opinion, it was the worst thing that ever happened to me.
Why was it the worst thing that ever happened to you?
My teacher only spoke Spanish and didn't translate.
That's called immersion, honey. Anyway, I gave it a rest. I still pepper Spanish into our daily routine, but it isn't much. This brings us back to the brave parents at the Family Nest. Owner Maria Palazzolo says it's really part Spanish school, part support group.
They're like, okay, whew, I'm not the only one. There's other people going through the same thing.
This includes Palazzolo, whose background is in early childhood education. She's Mexican-American, but she didn't speak any Spanish at home until her son was born 3 years ago.
Once I started talking to him in Spanish, I realized, like, wow, this is harder than I thought. I need to brush up on my Spanish a little bit more.
She started meetups for moms who could brush up together with their little ones. Then she opened the Family Nest. Mariela Salgado is a regular. She says she's trying to pass on much more than a language.
It's about an identity for ourselves, who we are, a piece of us to pass on to our kids.
My mom describes it this way.
Oh, we are passing traditions, things that we were taught by our parents and grandparents, and the love of the family.
That's quite a lot. So what happens if we try and fail? I spoke with Nina Hyams, a linguistics professor at UCLA.
There's been some interesting research that shows that even children who don't actively speak the language themselves, that if they're exposed to it, if they overhear it, at least in a home setting, that later on in their life, say when they're college age and they want to actually learn their heritage language, Spanish in this case, that they have an advantage.
I confess to her that when it comes to teaching my daughter Spanish, I feel like a slacker.
You do what you can. I'm a linguist. I'm not a priest. So I can't give you absolution for this. But based on the research that I'm familiar with, any kind of exposure has to be better than no exposure at all.
She might be onto something. The other day, Lucia told me she'd learned who founded the first California missions.
My teacher was pronouncing it Junipero Serra.
Which, she pointed out, is incorrect.
And how should it really be said?
Junipero Serra.
Muy bien.
Perhaps there is hope. For the California Report, I'm Leslie Bearstein Rojas in Los Angeles.
When you think comedians, you think funny, right? Well, there's a new book out that tells us a different story. It's called Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy. It chronicles the people who've made us laugh over the last century, and Peter Gilstrap discovered it's full of dark and often desperate stories.
You can lead a horse to water, but if you can teach him to lie on his back and float, then you got something.
That's Joe E. Lewis, once the Dane Cook of his day, now virtually forgotten. In 1927, he had his throat slit during a contract negotiation with an Al Capone associate, though he survived to joke again. Lewis was one of many nightclub comics working for the mob, a largely overlooked history, and a big part of author Cliff Nesteroff's book, which spans the laugh business from vaudeville to podcasting.
So for some reason, nobody has really talked about that in conjunction with comedians before. And to me, that is so much more interesting than a boring singer being connected to the mob. A guy who makes fun of people for a living, his boss is a humorless mafioso who could kill you. That dynamic to me is compelling.
Los Angeles-based Nesteroff, who's 35, started collecting vintage comedy albums as a teenager in British Columbia. That led to tracking down pretty much anyone he could reach involved with comedy on stage, screen, TV, or radio, meaning folks you've probably never heard of.
There was all this insight. These guys were obscure and their careers were nothing, but they had insight into the people that we did know. And that really built an incredible story that I was able to work from.
Guy went home one night and he told his wife, he said, "Baby, I just bought a skunk." She said, "Well, where you gonna keep him?" He said, "Under the bed." She said, "Well, what about that smell?" She said, "Oh, hell, let him get used to it like I did."
In 2006, he began sharing his stories on the website of New Jersey freeform station WFMU. Nesteroff developed an appreciative cult following that included Steve Martin, Mel Brooks, and Marc Maron.
I think the first piece I read was about Shecky Green. And I was so just amazed and engrossed with the way he captured show business. Because I have sort of that thing in my head. I am attracted to the dark crevices and the seediness and also the sort of the chaos of the personalities. And that piece he wrote on Shecky just blew my mind.
Maron was impressed enough to have Nesteroff on his WTF podcast, which helped land the book deal and a page one dedication.
He just has this amazing eye for lurid but compelling tales that don't necessarily diminish people, but you sort of feel like, well, of course these guys were like that.
For every Richard Pryor, Jonathan Winters, and Joan Rivers in the book, Nesteroff covers unfamiliar names like B.S. Pulley, Slick Slavin, and Bell Barth. But the author knows what it's like to get on stage as an unknown. Before focusing on writing, Nesteroff worked comedy clubs in Canada for 8 years.
The fact that Cliff was a stand-up, I think, was indispensable in the writing of this book, because it gives you a perspective that you can only have once you've done it.
Stand-up and former Simpsons writer Dana Gould is quoted in The Comedians as a pillar of the early 90s alt-comedy scene.
Because stand-up comedy is a lot like sex. You know, the only way to learn how to do it is to actually do it. And then once you've done it, you're full of shame.
That's the story of my life. No respect. I don't get no respect at all.
Because it's comedy, it is innately not as well respected. You know, Ken Burns can do the history of jazz, and it's the Parthenon. But comedy is like, well, we don't need to deal with that. It's just comedy.
But it's important stuff, says film critic and historian Leonard Maltin.
It's part of our popular culture, no less than movies or books or artwork of any kind. And what Cliff has done is he's taken something that no one else has bothered to chronicle or to take seriously. I think he nailed it.
Married 38 years and I'm still in love with the same woman. My wife finds out she'd kill me. Now you take my wife, please.
But seriously, folks, for the California Report, I'm Peter Gilstra in Los Angeles.
Thanksgiving is next week, and you know what that means.
Can I have some turkey?
Mom, can I have some mandu?
Food, and lots of it. And like lots of dinner parties, at the end of the meal, you're helping to clean up, and somebody turns to the host and says, "Hey, where should I put all this salad?" And the host says,
"Just toss it. We're never going to get around to eating it."
And you don't say it, but what you want to say is,
"Wait! I'll eat that."
That's Dana Gunders. She's a scientist with the NRDC, an environmental advocacy group, and she's got a Big Think. Big Think is a series we're doing on the California Report. We're asking Californians to share their big world-changing ideas in 10 words or less. Gunders' Big Think?
Making wasting food a social taboo.
Just like littering and smoking and driving drunk.
I'm really hoping that we can get to a point where it'll be looked down upon.
We Americans throw away 40% of our food. That's like buying 5 bags of groceries and then leaving 2 of them at the store. Gunder says it's become almost posh in America to throw away food, but it wasn't always this way.
We are wasting about 50% more than we did in the 70s. If you look back towards World War II, there was a huge campaign not to waste food and support our soldiers, you know, save food for them.
During World War II, there was a battle on the home front. Housewives were urged to save for the war effort.
There were actually posters, and they would say things like, "Food is a weapon, let's save it."
Gunder says the war is over, but food is just as valuable today.
When you think about all of the resources that go into getting food to our tables, the energy, the soil, the labor, the water, you know, in California, 80% of the water in this state is going towards growing food.
So when you throw out that food, you're throwing out the water, too. Not good in a drought.
And the fact that somebody else actually needs that food, it's really a moral tragedy that we're all okay with this.
Gunder says there are a few things creating this moral tragedy. The industrialization of food has made it cheaper and more accessible than ever in the U.S.
On one hand, we have 1 in 6 Americans who are food insecure, meaning they don't know where their next meal will come from. For the other segment of the population, food is low cost and not worth the inconvenience to really save it.
And Gunder says, as we've shifted away from being an agrarian society, we've become even more out of touch with the value of food.
You see this in programs in schools where they're gardening. When kids see how much it takes to grow a broccoli, they're much more willing to eat it and less excited about throwing it out.
That personally resonates with me because I've been gardening more. Like now, the tomato I grow, even if it's got a little hole in it from a bug, I'm just like, no, I'm going to eat the other half of that tomato because it took me months to grow that.
There is absolutely nothing that grows in my garden that would be sold in a store.
Do you feel like there's a little bit of germ phobia that's affected our food waste? Like, one thing I feel like I've heard a lot more than I did when I was a kid, leftovers have germs. Or we can't share our food with other people because they've got germs.
I do think we have more fear around our food than we used to. People often think that the expiration dates on food are telling them to throw the food out, that the food might make them sick. In fact, they are really manufacturer suggestions for when the food is at its freshest. They're not regulated. They're really just the best guess of the manufacturer. Our senses are very equipped to sense when you should not eat something because it's old. You know, it tastes funny, it's slimy, it has mold. Don't eat those things.
Gunder says not wasting food has taken on some urgency in recent years. At the same time that we're wasting more food than ever, we're also growing more of it too. And that's wreaking havoc on the environment. For example, livestock agriculture worldwide is one of the biggest contributors of greenhouse gases and destroyers of biodiversity. Now, if all this is bumming you out, Gunder says, don't despair.
The great news is that this is not climate change. You know, this is about making small changes in our daily habits around food.
And that brings us back to Thanksgiving and making wasting food a social taboo.
Hey, can I have another slice of the sweet potato pie?
Yeah, let me have some of that cranberry sauce.
The first step to not wasting food, know thyself.
Some people love leftovers and others won't touch them. If you're somebody who finds them gross, I'd first ask you to think about why. But I'd say be more careful about the portions that you're cooking.
And encourage your guests to take food home.
One other thing I've thought about is there's been a whole trend in carrying your own coffee mug to the coffee shop. And I've always thought, why don't we carry leftover containers around?
With that, I wish you all a happy Thanksgiving. And don't forget to bring that container for leftovers to your Thanksgiving meal. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Rocho. The engineer is Rob Spate. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes David Marks, David Weir, Lisa Pickoff-White, and Olivia Allen Price. Our interns are Natalia Estrada, Carrie Klein, and Laura Clivens. The California Report's editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Ingrid Becker, Taiki Hendricks, and Holly Kernan. I'm Queena Kim. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Support for the California Report comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. More at irvine.org. The California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.